Moncrief on News Talk.
If you know anything about Thin Lizzy, you'll almost certainly be familiar with the name Jim Fitzpatrick, who designed those striking covers. One of those albums, Nightlife, turns 50 this year. Jim, good afternoon.
Isn't that a scary thought?
Yes.
I'm only 52 and a half myself.
The posters you used to do of mythological figures.
Yeah.
Did that come before these album covers?
No, let's get it right. Nightlife would have come before my, just around the same time as my first attempts at Celtic work, Celtic goddesses, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And because the thing I suppose people might forget is that Thin Lizzy really leaned into their Irishness,
Your
covers were very much a representation of that.
Well, I was like Philip's mythological advisor.
that's a good title to have. Huge into all that. Yeah,
I give you a laugh about Nightlife. For people who don't know the image, it's got a panther in the foreground and this dark, dark city behind with the moon close up. And myself and Philip were walking down towards Shaftesbury Avenue for the launch. Mm. And we walked down and in HMV on the corner, like both sides and the front, was all Nightlife posters and record covers. And I said to Philip, we're both going, wow, look at this. And I said, Jesus, do you like the panther? And he says, oh, I love the panther. It's deadly. And I said, no, I said, the panther. And he said, what do you mean the panther? I said, it's the Black Panther, you know, Hugh Newton and all of that.
Yeah.
At that time, the Black Panthers were big,
yeah, you know,
and very anti-American establishment. And he said, you mean the Black Panthers? And I went, yeah, that's what this is about. And he said, oh, Jesus, don't tell anybody that. The BBC will block us. We won't get any coverage. And I had to keep my mouth shut up about 10 years ago, you know.
Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting.
But there you go.
Because it was there's a Sly Stone album that called "There's a Riot Going On,"
which
in the original cover.
I'm a huge fan of Sly.
Yeah, but and the American version has an American flag on it. But when it was issued in Europe, they took it off. They changed it for something else because they thought no one will buy it. It has an American flag on it.
We'd come through the Olympics with the two lads putting the fists up, like power salute. And Philip was slowly beginning to get into being black and Irish. I mean, he was always black and Irish, obviously, into the stronger side of it, shall we say. And of course, I was worse. I was egging him on.
Yes. So what were the circumstances in which you first met him? Was it he saw your art and then asked to meet you?
A colleague of yours, Eamon Carr, who was a journalist back then, and then went on to form Horselips. But at that time, he was a poet with Peter Fallon running a beat group that I was involved with. I was their graphic artist called Tara Telephone. And we had all these luminaries who were contributing to us, but Philip, there were happenings in Parnell Square, happenings in Ireland, can you imagine? Mm. There was nothing else going on. The place had been bombed, no bands would come here, nobody wanted to come near Ireland. And we had these happenings and Philip would turn up for them. But he didn't know me. We met each other briefly on the stairs of Roy Edmonds' studio up in Parnell Square back then. And we kind of nodded at each other. When we saw each other in town, we'd always say, how are you? Mm. You know? And I had long red hair sort of way down and Philip had a big afro. And, you know, we both wore bell bottoms to the point when we got to be friends. We used to swap clothes. But there was something about him. He had charisma. It's a much abused word, but he was, even to me, his friend, he was charismatic.
Mm.
He had presence. So, long story cut short, he was in Eamon Carr's flat. No, they call them apartments now, flat. Mm. And on the wall were two poster poems I had done for Tara Telephone, one for Peter Fallon and one for Eamon Carr, illustrating them with graphic design. One was printed silver and fuchsia. So if you looked at it, your eyes bobbled, right? It was the days of psychedelia. And Philip loved all this and said, oh, that's cool work. And he presumed it was West Coast. And Damon said, no, that's a local guy. He does loads of work for us. Now, all the work I did for them was free, so I was owed a promo somewhere. And Eamon put Philip in touch. And then Frank Murray, later manager of the Pogues, and myself played football for years in the Phoenix Park and other places. And Frank was Philip's best friend. And Frank came over with Philip then to introduce me. Because Tim Booth, another artist, was supposed to do the album covers. He was Philip's mate.
Yeah.
And he was a musician, and he still is, and a very good artist still. Even though we're all getting on a bit. I'm 80 last birthday, a couple of months ago. But Tim was in a band called Dr. Strangely Strange, and Chris Blackwell of Island Records had signed Strangely Strange, and he was told he couldn't do album covers for, who was that at the time, Decca.
So right, I got hired,
and Frank flew over with Philip. We met in Neary's, and we got on like a house on fire.
Yeah.
Because he loved my work. I loved Thin Lizzy. I mean, I really thought back then.
And what stage were Thin Lizzy at? Had they released albums at that point?
No, they had their first Thin Lizzy album out. That had classics on it, like Dublin. What was the one with the pregnant girl? Little Girl in Bloom.
Yeah.
About a woman I've since met and her son. We won't go there.
Okay.
Yeah. Fabulous people, by the way. And it was just a magical era. And if you could go back... We thought we were the bee's knees. I used to wear flared bell bottoms with Celtic designs on them by Bernadette Madden, a batik artist. And myself and Philip, far from strolling on opposite sides of Grafton Street, used to swan down it.
Yeah.
And I just loved being seen with the man. That's
yeah.
All. It can't be more tricky than that.
Oh, no, but it must have been an absolutely golden time.
It was fabulous, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody came over, and of course, they all loved Philip, you know? And I'd bathe in the glory, you know?
Yeah.
Same in England, when we'd walk down Portobello. Everybody would want to know Philip, and I'd be just his appendage, you know, happily signing autographs and things. Once they copped on, they did the covers, stuff like that. But it was Philip's show, you know.
And what was the process of doing the covers? And would you go through many iterations of ideas, or how did that work with them?
Well, Nightlife is a classic. If you go on my website, I won't give a plug. If you go on my website, you see the process of it, if you can find it. But the cover is a photo montage. The panther is drawn. The city is an entire photo montage from a book on New York. And I pasted all the skyscrapers together on negative paper, right, to turn into a positive piece of film that I then airbrushed and painted. It's all old style art. Nobody knows anything about this. I'm recoloring The Rocker at the moment. It's on my website or on my Facebook pages and Instagram. Because I'm learning computer digital art. I love it. My grandkids can do it and I can't.
Yeah.
So now I'm doing new stuff. You
is,
know?
Because some of them, you know, I'm trying to think now which album it is that has the cover, and it's Johnny the Fox, and it has that very ornate artwork all around.
Oh, that's one of the most, that's my best work.
Did that take a hell of a long time to do? Because that kind of work, and you did a lot of this kind of stuff.
It took months, but Philip was very clever. He used to say to me, come up with some ideas for anything you like. You know what I mean? Mm. Because we have an album, but no titles, no nothing. So he got me working on just ideas, and I did a kind of a War of the Worlds thing because I was into that after Jailbreak. But around it, I put this neo-Celtic border, you know, and I didn't think. I knew Philip liked that kind of work, but didn't want to be an Irish Celtic Cayley band. You know what I mean? Didn't want that look. So I gave it a heavy metal kind of look. And he loved it. And he said, come on, get started on that now. And I said, yeah. And I rang the manager and said, he wants me to get started on this. What is it? And the manager said, I don't know. Because they were paying.
Yeah.
At least the record company were paying. Mm. And I started on the, I said, are you sure you're going to use this? And he said, oh, geez, yeah, I don't know what we're going to do, but I'm using that. That's the next album cover. And he was under enormous pressure immediately to do that album. And it shows in some of the work because it's not as finished as he would have liked it or anybody would have liked it. But I got a chance on the cover and I took it, but we'd no title. So he said, leave a gap in the middle. So I did that circle.
Ah.
But right up to a couple of, like 2 weeks before it was coming out, I was ringing Philip saying, I have no idea. What are we doing here? Now, I did try to pull a stroke. I said to him, if you can get me a photograph of a fox, because he was talking about it being called Johnny the Fox, I said, I'll stick the fox's head on top of the photographs I have of you. I'd love the photographs taken by Mick Rock, a superb photographer. So I got, they photographed the fox, don't ask me how. It was a stuffed fox, and it was like this, with the wide eyes, and I stuck it on Philip's head, photo montaged it. I was good at that, I was trained in advertising, and I made the eyes flare. And in those days, you had to send it over. You couldn't show it on your phone and transmit it.
This is post.
You know,
yeah.
We were on a dial-up phone and sending things by post. So the courier arrived immediately and took it over. Had it the next morning. He rang me and said, Jesus, we're not using that. He said it frightened the you-know-what out of me.
Yeah.
And it is scary, and I'm kind of glad maybe they didn't. So he said, just do something with Nightlife with a fox. So I did the fox looking like it was towering, looking over the city like nightlife. But I always felt it was a bit weak compared to the first idea. But it's the
Do you still
border
have that
itself.
First idea?
Well, I have a copy of it. Yeah, absolutely. It's scary.
God, yeah.
Because like he's got the medallion on. And it looks like it could be filled, but it's a fox's head. It looks bizarre. That's the only way to describe it.
Wow, okay. And so did you do, apart from prior to when the two of you met, did you do every album cover?
For a long time after that. It slowed down when two things happened. One, Lizzie became not so hot in the record business. And when you're not hot in the record business, they kind of slam doors.
Yeah.
You know, to get the fees I was getting that the management were getting me, you wouldn't get today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I knew this gravy train had to end sometime. Mm. And it did. And it ended with a kind of a bang because it annoyed me. There was an album cover called The Adventures of Tin Lizzie, and they hired a comic book artist to do it, who's a real comic book artist. I'm not. I didn't want the comic books. But I remember thinking, that's the first time. Now, they used photographs before, but it's the first time they used another artist. Now, Philip was very apologetic.
Yeah.
But the guy was a comic book artist. I'm not. So I can understand how he got the gig. But I thought, I could always do the cover.
Yeah.
I would have done it for free. Because working for Lizzie was the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah, of course.
For a young artist who nobody ever heard of.
Yeah. And you did mention advertising.
I worked in advertising for years, yeah.
And advertising would have been well paid. You would have been.
I was earning more than the President of Ireland. Can you imagine giving that up to be an artist?
Crikey.
Seriously, and guess what happened next? The economy collapsed. We had the oil crisis where I had to queue for like hours to get petrol.
Mm.
And I'm giving up this big job.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, with the intervention of Tin Lizzie, everything worked out and all that. But my God, it was touch and go.
Yeah. Now, to go back even further, because I assume this was before you were just a young lad when you were working in the hotel in Clare.
Mm-hmm.
And Che Guevara walks in the door.
It's like a cartoon joke,
isn't it?
It's
like a cartoon, yeah.
Man works in a bar, Che Guevara walks in. What do you talk about, Ian?
No, because they had to stay, because their plane, there were a problem with the weather or something, they had to stay in Shannon.
They were fogbound in Shannon. There's a lot of flights for back then, because, and I love telling people this, the Russians had an airbase in Shannon.
Yeah.
And I was there a couple of times, always full of Nicaraguans and bell-bottoms and Cubans. It looked like, you know, they've just seen a fashion magazine and wore everything they could, you know, in Moscow duty-free as they flew over to Shannon. But anyway, I'm working in the bar in the Royal Marine Hotel in Kilkee. And it's a Sunday morning. I'm open up after Mass around 12 o'clock. And I'd say about 1 o'clock on a lovely sunny day, in walked Che Guevara. Now, I was educated by Franciscans. I went to school in Gormson College. It was Franciscans. They had missions all over Latin America. So I learned the history of Latin America from an Irish perspective.
Mm.
O'Higgins of Chile, the Liberator.
Yes.
Bolivar's army, all Napoleonic Irish generals and troops. The founder of the Argentine Navy, Admiral Brown. Raoul Walsh, the Companero. I could give you a list of all the, and O'Reilly of Cuba, of course. And I knew this stuff, and I think I kind of, I hate to say, I was actually, the more you talk, the better the tip. So I was a talker, right? And I learned to talk and get plenty of tips. And here I was with one of my heroes that I knew exactly who he was. He was surprised I recognized him. And one of the very first things he said to me, and his English wasn't perfect, but I could understand him quite easily. He said, "I'm Irish." And when Che Guevara says,
because was it his grandmother or something?
His great-grandmother, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He spoke to Maureen O'Hara about it in Great Lent. You can Google it, Maureen O'Hara and Che Guevara. And Maureen said to him, "How do you know so much about Irish independence and the struggle for independence?" And he said, "I've read every book on the subject," but he said, "Everything I learned about Ireland, I learned on my grandmother's knee."
Mm.
So he's very proud, and they all are still. I met the head of the Irish Argentinian Association a couple of years ago. He came over here. He looked like me. He was a big tall redhead.
Now, the thing is, though, is that when I say Che Guevara now, anyone listening who knows who that is, the image that will pop into their head is the image you created.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did he look like that when you first saw him? Was he wearing a beret?
He looked more like Colin Farrell. Colin, when before, you know, not now, but the younger guy with the big mane of hair. Do you remember that look?
Yeah.
Very thick hair, and he's about the same height as well. Colin is about, you know, what is he, about 5'8"?
Yeah.
You know? But no, very, I found him very humorous. He had a kind of a mischievous grin the whole time.
Mm.
Because he was listening to this kid of 16 ranting on about the Irish Revolution in Latin America. You know? That's, and he was talking about General Tom Barry. That was his hero.
Yeah.
You know?
So what age were you when you made that
I
image?
I was 16, in 1961.
When you made that?
Oh, no, when I made it, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I did the first image of Shea before he was murdered in 1967 for a magazine called Scene Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of a series of things called A Voice in Our Time. And when he was murdered, I turned that image into a black and white poster, not the red and black one.
Mm.
That came in December of 67 for an exhibition in May 1968 in London called Viva Shea. And they asked me to do a poster for that, and that's what that was for. Unfortunately, everything disappeared, artwork, everything. But I kept, I'd given them, I had a machine that could make photographs, like a plate glass camera. And I had the original, I sent them a photo of it, you know, montaged into a poster. And that became the famous red and black image.
Now, and clear this up, because probably as many people who would be familiar with that would have a different story. Was the image stolen from you? Did you say, no, I wanted to be free to the world?
You got it in one. I announced proudly in the Evening Press in an interview, a full page interview, that I was making it free for the masses. Now, I barely didn't use the word proletariat. That's how lefty I was. So it was free for the masses. And because it had already been ripped off, and I thought, hold on, I worked in advertising. I know how copyright works. You can close them down. But I thought, no, let it proliferate. And I made a statement that I wanted it to breed like rabbits. And that's exactly
what it did. That's exactly what it did. But also at the same time, other people all over the world had made millions from your work.
Well, Corda, the guy who took the photograph that I used for my image, he said that my poster made his photo famous. But he also said that the publisher, Fettronelli, a Red Brigade radical, who owned the Fettronelli bookshops in Milan, they're still there, one opposite the Duomo I go to. My daughter lives there. And Fettronelli kind of stole it. He was given it with Jean-Paul Sartre in Cuba, because I've done the history of all this, you know.
Mm.
I'm good friends with Lillier de Guevara, his daughter. I spent 3 days with her and the ambassador. So I know the history of it. But Corda always felt ripped off. He never earned a penny from that. And he said that Fettronelli made millions. Now, Cubans exaggerate. I know the poster business. Fettronelli would have made money, a couple of hundred grand maybe, but that's it. But Corda got nothing.
Yeah. So then, was it 2012 or something?
2012, I recopyright. Right, because I'm the artist, I own the copyright anyway.
Yeah.
I can do what I like with it.
Yeah.
But there's a brand of cigarette out called Shea with the image on the front.
Oh my God.
I have them. I've kept copies of it. I was going to take a case against them, and then found that my image had been handed over to the cigarette company worth $1.5 billion a year by the EU IPO. I have this in paper. They handed my image over without even asking me. They're supposed to be protecting artists' rights in Europe. But that's another story.
That's another story. Yeah. That's another story.
Extraordinary, you know?
So now, since you've reasserted, do you still occasionally have to keep an eye out to see if somebody ripping it off?
I try. It's only stuff like cigarette companies bother me, because they have plenty of money. It's out in Japan now. But I don't have the money to take on a company that has a turnover of $1.5 billion a year. You know what I mean? Now, there was a lawyer going to handle it. She was going to take it to the French courts with a better chance, because the French recognise the artist's integrity always first. But I'm 80 years old. Do I want to spend my life over in Europe fighting in a court that'll go? They'll drag it on forever. You know how the law works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you ever regret making it free for the masses?
Not at all. That's the only aberration. Some right-wing, you couldn't make it up. Years ago, I had Searchlight, which is an anti-fascist site, informed me that there was a German anti-immigrant group using it. And I thought, how are they using Shea for anti-immigration and right-wing stuff? But people do. And they're the only ones I don't like using it. I shut them down if I can.
Yeah. It's like a lot of people use George Orwell and without knowing anything about that George Orwell was a lifelong socialist.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? But anyway, you know, the good news is I'm very proud of it. It's still around, and I think I've used it for the right reasons.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Yeah, it's an no, that even of itself, because you were only like a young guy. That's an extraordinary achievement that went all the way around the world and still does.
I have to give you a laugh. At the time, I don't think I've told anybody this. I was working for an advertising agency called Wilson Hartnell. The two directors were Sean O'Brody and Michael Maughan, lovely guys, but both very right-wing Catholics. And they saw the image, because I had a poster stuck up behind me in the studio I worked in, right? Mm. And they started a new company called Wilson Hartnell PR, and they used the PR company to promote it. So it was in all the, like, vast publicity that cost me nothing. All they had to say was, Jim Fitzpatrick is an art director at Wilson Hartnell.
Mm.
And they made it go viral. Would you believe that?
Jim says, met Jim walking on Howth Pier a few years ago. A lovely man. And we spoke about the Shea image. He was taking pictures with a hot blonde.
What does that mean?
Is that the kind of thing you'd normally do when you're on the pier in Howth?
On Howth Pier.
Yeah. Dez, who's in Limerick, says, I've loved Jim's work since the 70s. Everything from Nuada of the Silver Arm through to the Lizzie albums through to the Book of Conquests. He inspired me to start looking into Celtic art and not work. Absolute icon, says Dez.
Thank you.
What kind of work are you doing today?
I've just finished. I started a project many years ago, God forgive me, called Mostly Women, and I've drawn all my friends for, 30, 40 years now. So the very first person I ever used as a model, still a great friend of mine. To close it off, I'm doing a portrait of her daughter, right? And that's, I've just finished that, and it feels good. You know, I haven't shown to them yet. I'm just trying to make sure she looks like maybe one side of her lip is a bit, you know, monkey, so I have to fix that. But it's a nice way to round something off. I figure at my age, I better start closing things down instead of reopening. But I've reopened the whole world of, you know, digital colouring and digital graphics, and I love all that stuff. AI, my God, what you can... I've done thousands of images with AI just to figure how I can turn my work into that kind of work.
Mm.
It's funny, you get these beautiful goddesses I've created, but now and then they've like three legs or something. You know, there's two legs in the front and you see this other at the back. So they're obviously stealing it from everywhere, including myself.
Yeah.
There's a guy who had to put a page up, AI derived from Jim Fitzpatrick art, and it's like, whoa. I'm going, holy God, that's good.
Yeah.
You know?
So, but would you worry about
not
AI
at all.
Then?
I worry for younger artists because imagine you've created a character, you know, like a Marvel Comics character, an Irish character, Finn McCool type of thing. And you put years of your life into that and you bring a book out and it's all that work. That's simply fed into a computer.
Mm.
And then it becomes one of the source, like tens of thousands of images become the source material for one picture. Right? Now you can go back. The ideal solution would be anybody whose work is used gets a piece of the action. But I used a reference to an Italian artist in one of my works, a contemporary Italian graphic artist, and they gave me imitations of his work and my style. Now, I fed one of my works in as well.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So where this is going is scary for artists. It really is. And for writers, they can rip off everything you've ever written. So it's to have some way of defining the sources that people get a share. But right now, it's a free-for-all.
Yeah. So that is kind of a bit of a worry.
It's fascinating.
And all the portraits you've done of women, what do you plan to do with these portraits?
I was going to do a book, but now because it's so personal, it's like my whole life would be exposed. I don't mean in any nasty way.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I just feel, I'm at the point in my life where I think, let's just finish it and leave it. Right.
Okay.
In 50 years, 70 years' time, their grannies or grandchildren will all be looking at this going, wow, look at my granny. Wasn't she stunning?
Yeah.
You know? But it's a lot of it is very personal. Like my best friend is in it all the time, featuring. She's very proud of it. There's nothing to be ashamed of in any of it. But it's so deeply personal. And then there's other people that you just did when you met them or people you ran into and people like that. You know what I mean? It's kind of casual. So I'm trying to emphasize the people who are important in my life with the work. So maybe I'll do a small edition of it privately on my website or something.
Mm.
I don't want to be faced with interviews about all these women.
Well,
I go nuts.
Yeah, that is interesting. And in that obviously the work is still important to you, but maybe not validation from outside isn't maybe as important.
There's
anymore.
Nothing worse than men talking about women. That's what I'd be doing. With
yeah,
a
that's
like
true.
That.
Yeah,
that would drive me insane. Listen to myself, even.
Yes, that's a fair point. Jim, absolute joy having you. Thanks a million for coming in to talk to us. That was Jim Fitzpatrick there, of course.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.